I don't know whether it's a trait of personality of mine or everybody's really, but once I start thinking about an exhortation, my mind runs along similar lines all the time. I don't know why it is, unless I'm specifically looking at something else. But this time I was looking, really taking the last few days' readings, and one of the things that always crosses my mind is how Jesus spoke to us in so many different ways, and the ways that he spoke to the people, of course. And the initial one, I'll just look at one or two of these things. He talked in parables, and you think to yourself, well, parables, you know, when we were small and we're doing, well, I was in a Church of England Sunday School at that particular time, you know, we used to get taught the parables, although it is 60 years, Jeff, this last month since we first came to Christadelphian Youth Circle, isn't it?
I think so, yes.
Yeah, 60 years, I was just thinking that, 60 years this month. And when... just that's by the by, not of importance, but there we are. And that led us to, those who weren't in the youth circle, obviously at that time, I mean, Peter Reynolds had the youth circle, and we used to always have a good 20 minutes, half an hour, discussing biblical topics of all sorts of things, and then we used to go on to doing other things and enjoying ourselves generally, and it was... all that really that started it all. Anyway, in Matthew 30, that's aside, Matthew 13, verses 11, somewhere here, it's when the actual disciples say to him, the disciples went to him and said, why do you speak to them in parables? He replied, it has been granted to you to know the secrets of the kingdom of heaven, but to those others it has not been granted. For the man who has will be given more, till he has enough and to spare, and for the man who has not will forfeit even what he has. That is why I speak to them in parables, for they look without seeing and they listen without hearing or understanding. And so it goes on, and you think to yourself, so what he's really saying to them, yes, I'm talking to you in a very straightforward, easily understood story, depending on what the circumstances and what particular parable it is, and you can easily understand my story, but that's not the point. You know, just think about it in more depth. And those who want to think about it in more depth can think about it in more depth. And those who don't want to, obviously let it pass them by. So it was important because it's, and this is part of, you know, my thoughts, and it'll probably go on in free will and how God directs things, but I don't think he directs every moment, because if he did, that would give the free will I think I have. So we really have got to choose to do things in a way from ourselves, so that we are not just puppets, but we are positively thinking in a direction which God wants us to do. And I think this is what he was saying then, because this is why I speak to the powers, for they look without seeing and listen without hearing or understanding. And then he goes on about the prophecy of Isaiah. So that's the way it was to them, and that's the way he spoke to them, and that's the way he wanted them to think about it. Whereas to others, I mean, for example, go back to the previous chapter, at this some of the doctors of the law and the Pharisees said, Master, we should like you to show us a sign. And he answered, it is a wicked, godless generation that asks for a sign, and the only sign that will be given is the sign of the prophet Jonah. Jonah was in the sea monster's belly for 3 days and three nights, and at the same way the Son of Man will be 3 days and three nights in the bowels of the earth. At the judgment, when this generation is on trial, the men of Nineveh will appear against it and assure its condemnation, for they repented at the preaching of Jonah. So it was a different answer given to people who supposedly were the more... legal-minded, those the law, those who had probably had an awful lot of education in that direction, because that's the way they went, and that's the way they thought of things. But they also felt, and I think the Jews, I get the impression reading the books, that they did like things in a more positive way. They did like positive signs and positive ways of doing things. Maybe they've changed a little bit recently, because I was listening to that think the chief rabbi was on the radio this morning, and he sounded to speaking slightly differently, but they do seem to be in that direction. And the doctors of the law, the Pharisees, wanted more tangible signs. The Jewish religion, the way of life, was riddled with practices and ceremonies and duties, and they didn't like the way that Jesus did things that altered their way of life. They wanted something more tangible that they could do to please God and the way that they'd been taught. Something crossed my mind and I forgot what it was. I didn't write it down. The miracle of the loaves and fishes impressed many. Why? Obviously because many of them were hungry. Many of them had to work very hard for their food and their general well-being. So when they saw the miracle of the loaves and fishes, they obviously saw something tangible there that Jesus could do for them. And not only did it in a way that was, it was miraculous, but it wasn't, I don't think in that sense, it wasn't like a conjuring trick. It was more that here were the loaves and fishes and everyone got part of it. They all ate enough. They were all filled. And yet Jesus hadn't done anything that was sort of magical. It was done in a way that they could understand that he had the power to do, but in a way that they didn't really understand. And then, of course, you've got individuals. I mean, just after that particular episode, I think it is, when they returned to the crowd, a man came up to Jesus, fell on his knees before him and said, "Have pity, sir, on my son. He is an epileptic and has bad fits and keeps falling about, often into the fire, often into the water. I brought him to your disciples, but they could not cure him." Jesus answered, "What an unbelieving and perverse generation. How long shall I be with you? How long must I endure you? Bring him here to me." Jesus then spoke sternly to the boy. The devil left him, and from that moment he was cured. So that was another way they spoke. He did things which were more of a overtly miraculous nature that they saw, I mean, or at least this man saw. I don't know how many people actually saw it, that this boy was cured in that sort of way. And when one thinks that general life expectancy around then, I think, was around about 40 years, although some of the more senior people did live a lot longer than that, because probably they got better food to eat and more of it, and were able to do things that the other members of the general populace couldn't do. You can imagine how Jesus doing these things of feeding people and curing people was extremely important. Now, the priests, of course, disliked this. They just felt they were being undermined, I believe. They thought, how is this man they saw come along here and he does these things? And Jesus did accept the appellation Son of Man, generally, not Son of God, Son of Man. But why, they thought, could he do these things? How could he be that he could be here and be so positive in this sort of way? And of course, Jesus makes it clear to them that it won't always be like this, which was really something they didn't think about in that sort of way. I think Matthew 16, I looked at verse 21. From that time, Jesus began to make it clear to his disciples that he had to go to Jerusalem and there to suffer from the elders, chief priests and doctors of the law, to be put to death and to be raised again on the third day. At this, Peter took him by the arm and began to rebuke him. "Heaven forbid," he said. "No, Lord, this shall never happen to you." And Jesus turned and said to Peter, "Away with you, Satan. You're a stumbling block to me. You think as men think and not as God thinks." And so Jesus is now telling them that he will suffer and he will be condemned by those around him, even though many of them at the time with him couldn't possibly understand why that should be the case or why that should happen. It was a position that even Peter, for example, couldn't accept, and that's why he says in here, "Lord, this shall never happen to you." Jesus was to them a new leader, and I sometimes wonder when I try to think of what Jesus did in those days, because it's very hard to believe, not believe, but to understand how people dealt with things and how things went on. But he was a man who apparently had come from humble roots in the eyes of many, who was outspoken, he was practical, he could do miraculous things, he spoke with authority, and he could answer the priests and the leaders. It was completely different situation. No one has spoken like that before to those in authority, and they just believed therefore that it was very remarkable that he should be able to continue in this way. In Matthew 11:25, he says, "At that time Jesus spoke with these words, 'I thank thee, Father, Lord of heaven and earth, for hiding these things from the learned and wise and revealing them to the simple. Yes, Father, such was thy choice. Everything is entrusted to me by the Father, and no one knows the Son but the Father, and no one knows the Father but the Son, and those to whom the Son may choose to reveal him.'" And so he goes on, "Come on unto me, all those whose work is hard, whose load is heavy, and I will give you relief." And of course the Pharisees noticed them plucking and eating corn on the Sabbath. I mean, Sabbath is the Hebrew word for rest, I think. Not that I'm in any way a Hebrew scholar, but looking it up, it said rest. And so it was absolutely different from their normal behaviour. Nobody would have gone round plucking the corn and eating it on a Sunday. And yet, here they are. Jesus went through the cornfields on the Sabbath, and feeling hungry, began to pluck some ears of corn and eat them. And the Pharisees noticed this, and they said to him, "Look, at your disciples are doing something which is forbidden on the Sabbath." And he answered, "Have you not read what David did when men were hungry? He went into the house of God and ate the sacred bread." So there again, he's doing something completely different from what everybody else would have done. And I mean, it was a bit of a rebel in that sense. I mean, in the sense that he just wasn't conforming to what everybody wanted. He was doing something in a way that he could teach them, and they would understand that he was quite different. And on another occasion, of course, a man was there with an arm in the synagogue, and he asked Jesus, "Is it permitted to heal on the Sabbath?" They wanted to frame a charge against him, but he said to them, "Suppose you had one sheep which fell into a ditch on the Sabbath. Is there not one of you who would catch hold of it and lift it out? And surely a man is worth far more than a sheep. It is therefore permitted to do good on the Sabbath." So Jesus was teaching them in a way that quite new. And the priests didn't, cynical about this in a sense, because I think they use the word, they say, or call, in Matthew 26:50, "Hail Rabbi," I think, which was "Hail Teacher." Oh, so we've got the new teacher here, the new things. He's doing things which we would have never thought about or done, and he's doing it in a way that, with authority, which we don't really like. The priests really felt that they were undermined. Their authority was undermined, as he usurped their power, and of course the only charge that could come against him was blasphemy. And I was just going to read a couple of verses from Matthew 26. Jesus led off under arrest to the house of Caiaphas the high priest, where the lawyers and the elders were assembled, and Peter followed in a distance till he came to the high priest's courtyard. And going in, he sat down there among the attendants, meaning to see the end of it all. The chief priests and the whole council tried to find some allegation against Jesus on which the death sentence could be based, but they failed to find one, though many came forward with false evidence. Finally, two men alleged that he had said, "I can pull down the temple of God and rebuild it in 3 days." At this, the high priest rose and said, "Have you no answer to the charge that these witnesses bring against you?" But Jesus kept silence. And the high priest said, "By the living God, I charge you to tell us, are you the Messiah, the Son of God?" "Those are your words," Jesus said. And so the high priest then goes on to say, "Blasphemy, blasphemy." And it's so odd to think that Jesus was trying to do all the things which were not blasphemy, as it were, but here they were turning against him. And remember that, I just say this on the side, because I forget that Annas was Caiaphas's father-in-law, I think. They were all a bit related, so there was a certain connection between them. So Jesus was brought before Pilate, and I don't think Pilate at first really was interested. I mean, I think he would have set him free, and he felt pressure from the priests and the turncoat people. I think we've discussed this before, and I think, as Jeff was saying to me, some people felt that, you know, the crowd may have been a bit of a renter crowd, but whether they were, I don't know. It's so easy. I mean, when you've seen these recent riots and things in Ukraine and other parts of the world, it seems that people can change their minds and do things very drastic in a very short period of time. And I think sometimes that here, when they discovered that Jesus was being condemned for blasphemy, they probably felt, I don't want to be associated with this. I better keep out of the way. I don't say that would have turned them completely, but certainly it would have had some effect. And what was I going to read? He questioned it at some length without getting any reply, but the chief priests and lawyers appeared and pressed the case against him vigorously. Then Herod and his troops treated him with contempt and ridicule and sent him back to Pilate, dressed in a gorgeous robe. The same day, Herod and Pilate became friends. Till then, there'd been a standing feud between them. Two things, just two asides I had. One is, I read something in, now this won't be the same Herod, those of you the more historians among you, tell me more about this, but you know, I was thinking of the pressure on Jesus when he was doing these things, and sometimes you don't realise the total power that people had. Now the Herod that was alive when Jesus was born, I don't think it's the same Herod that's here. I think he's the next one down. But I was reading this bit out, Tony gave me this magazine and I happened to see this, but it's about Herod. I don't know, just read a few words. He said, if I can find the right, random. Oh, here we are. Today, Herod, oh, surely, Herod is the best known as a sly and murderous monarch of Matthew's Gospel, who slaughtered every male infant in Bethlehem in an unsuccessful attempt to kill the newborn Jesus, the prophesied king of the Jews. During the Middle Ages, he became an image of the Antichrist. Illuminated manuscripts and Gothic gargoyles show him tearing his beard in mad fury and brandishing his sword at luckless infants with Satan whispering in his ear. Now it says here, Herod is most certainly, almost certainly innocent of this particular crime, whether they have the, I don't know, of which there is no report apart from Matthew's account, but children he certainly slew, including three of his own sons, along with his wife, his mother-in-law, and numerous other members of his court. Throughout his life, he blended creativity and cruelty, harmony and chaos in ways that challenge the modern imagination. And so, obviously it's written by somebody, I don't know who. But you know, when you think of the power that these people had to actually do these sort of things, it wasn't like the arguments we have today and somebody gets maybe hit or put in prison or something or other. These people had the power to just wipe you out like that if they thought something against you. And yet Jesus was now doing these things in this way. Now, as I say, I know the Herods changed then, and I know the Herods, I think the Herod that was there when Jesus was born died about a year after he was born. I think that was the period when it took over. So then we got a different one. But nevertheless, they were all very powerful and could do a lot of things in that sort of way. Some of the completely other aside, this just cropped up when I was doing that reading. I read a letter, somebody, this is nothing of interest other than perhaps you can think about it. In a letter in the Christadelphian recently, it said, in the kingdom we probably won't, we'll be like the angels and won't eat and drink. And I was a bit puzzled at that, simply because I did read that in Luke there that we just read, they were going to eat and drink in the kingdom. Jesus ate some fish after he rose from the dead and broke bread as well. And then in the Old Testament, some angels were entertained unawares. Now, I was a bit surprised that you'd be entertained somebody unawares if they didn't eat or, you know, I mean, I don't know what entertainment they did, but anyway, just an aside that cropped into my head when I was reading that, so maybe you can explain it all to me at some point. So I say all this just to remind you how different Jesus was to all the others and who preached, and how he preached the people. Jesus was so pragmatically addressing each situation he was in. He went and ate with those that the priests regarded as sinners. He helped those who others wouldn't have even touched. And so when we come here to examine ourselves, it's not, I don't see it as examine ourselves in a sort of tick box situation, like, have I murdered anybody this week? Yes, no. You know, have I committed adultery this week? Yes, no. Or have I stolen anything this week? I can't see examining myself in that way, because I see Jesus, if we think of him at all, as a friend, not somebody who's come in here and do as, you know. He's a friend. And I think that he's, what he's really saying is, change your whole mind in the way that you work and do and play and deal with each other. So if he came here now, he might say to you, and I make this up, I know you come here each week and you think about examining yourself and you remember me and you do it and you ask for forgiveness for sins. Now let me ask you another question. Tell me in 3 or 4 sentences, or write down in 3 or 4 sentences, why you think you should be in the kingdom. And it, to me, it makes a different feeling about it, because it means that you've got to be not negative, saying, well, I didn't do that, Lord, and I've been good at that, and I didn't do this, but rather what I could have done and what I should be doing and how I should be doing it. And so I feel this is, it's different from the Jews who like some straightforward rules that, you know, you're going to do this, you're going to do that, if you do that, you're better, and if that, you're worse. It's rather the whole changing of the mind. And so we come here and we ask him for forgiveness, and we think about all the trials and tribulations that he had. And recently I was listening to one of our speakers not long ago, and he was talking about all the trials and tribulations that people might have in their lives and what they had. And we probably won't get the trials that Jesus had or anything like them. But I was reading an obituary the other day, and it struck me, even though it doesn't relate to me directly, but it was about a Czech-born Jewess. At the beginning of the war, she, together with her husband and son, her father and mother and her brother, were all interned in Auschwitz. Her father, her mother, her husband, her brother were all killed by the Nazis. Because she was a concert pianist, and the Nazis liked to pretend that their world that was humane, they formed an orchestra, and she was the concert pianist, and so they kept her alive. And she survived at the end of the war with her son, came to live in London, and with her son, she continued to play the piano and taught. And she died recently at the age of 110. And I thought, first of all, I thought, you know, fancy somebody going through all that, still in London. And one of the last things she said was, and this is what I took note of, as she was approaching old age, she said she used to say, when she woke in the morning, she thanked God I'd been blessed with another wonderful day of life. And I thought, it just struck me that a person has gone through all that horror and losing a father and mother, a husband and a brother at Auschwitz, could still say that. I haven't been through those ordeals, but I just can't imagine in my own mind how I would react to such a situation. So let's look at our lives in a positive way, with a free will, looking and reading and thinking about the things we're now going to do. I don't use the word truth very much, to be honest. I usually say to people, this is the way I understand the Bible, simply because from 1976 to 1989, I had a very close colleague who was a Plymouth Brother, and he was convinced that I was wrong in many ways, and kept telling me that I hadn't got the truth and he'd got the truth. He wasn't an exclusive brother. He would sit and eat with you, but he was certainly, made you... I went to a Bible class or two with him, and you could see that, you know, we had differences, and what could you do? And there was another one, there was a Seventh-day Adventist. Now Mike was quite calm. He would talk to you in a very... Seventh-day Adventist, oh no, he was all very positive and, you know, bash out what he wanted to do. So now I tend to say to people, look, this is the way I understand it, and if you want to talk about any bits, we'll talk about it in that way. And in fact, I was thinking about this when... Andrew Perry was speaking the other week, and he was saying, when he was a young man, he was wondering whether he should be a Catholic or a Jew or something. I can't remember exactly what his words were, but he'd obviously gone through the thought process of whether I'm in the right track or whether there's some other track that I can see which I can't do. And we will continue to have challenges, because on this weekend, as you know, they've changed the definition of the word marriage by law in the UK. So this is going to not impact on us immediately, but these things do impact. And I know that, as you know, we've had a case of gender realignment, I think they call it, and that has caused enormous problems to some of my family. And even mentioning of these things in a derogative manner, I mean, I remember a young woman who once had a course with, and we were sitting down to lunch, this is a long time ago, 20 years ago, and this subject of homosexuality cropped up. And I wasn't going to say anything nasty, I was being quite objective, but she leapt up in the air, said, "I can't possibly eat my lunch with you," and disappeared to the other end of the canteen. And it was, and I wasn't being nasty, I was merely trying to be objective. Well, why do I mention all this? Because this comes to my final point, really, and that's that when I was listening to, who was it? Was it last week? We were talking about hymns. Was that Richard Jones, was it? Yeah. And I was thinking about all the hymns that I think about, and that I try to, actually, if I read the words too much, I make mistakes on the playing, so it's difficult to always get the, think of the words all at the same time. But there's one hymn which, when I first played it at my sister's wedding in 1965, December 1965, and it's hymn now 151, and the words are written by Oliver Wendell Holmes, who was a Boston American, who started off as a lawyer, but then disliked the law, and so he became a physician, and he, for the rest of his life, from 1809 to 94, and he was a poet and writer. His father was a Calvinist, but he was open to, I think, a bit more wider-ranging Christian beliefs. But wherever he was, the verse that always gets me in the end and makes me think, and I think brings me to the frame of mind to take in the bread and wine, and that's the fourth verse of hymn 151, which says, "Grant us thy truth to make us free, and kindling hearts that yearn for thee, lit by thy word with heavenly flame, whose name shall glorify thy name."